So, Chris, I got some news for you. I have encrypted your data, and if you want your data back, you have to give me $500 in Bitcoin.
$500 in Bitcoin?
$500 in Bitcoin.
Well, where do I get a Bitcoin?
I don't really know, but I just want in on that scheme because it seems like an easy way to make money from people is to encrypt their data and then offer them a unlock key for the small price of $500 in Bitcoin.
Well, that doesn't sound too terrible. How do we get in on this?
We'll talk about that a little bit later. But we want to start with some continuation from last week. We mentioned Story Remix from Windows 10, the Windows Movie Maker replacement. It looks like it's not going to be a standalone app, according to this article from The Verge. Or maybe just right now in the new build of Windows 10, it's going to be available in the native Photos app in Windows 10. Which is good in some ways because the app is going to be there, and bad in some ways because it's going to be in the same app, and sometimes we like features to be separate.
I think that's some good news because it does clarify that one question that I had was, how much does it cost? Well, it doesn't cost anything. And being that the Photos app is universal, it's going to be available on Windows, Windows Phone, and Xbox. So, good news. It's everywhere.
It seems like that's becoming a trend with all the big names. Apple's built all their new features into their Photos app. Google's doing the same thing in Photos, which we'll talk a little bit about the Photos app later when we talk about Google I.O. So it really does kind of make a lot of sense to build those features into the Windows 10 photo app. So
yeah, if we're using the camera app to take pictures and video and they all go into the Photos app for syncing, well, let's just put everything in there, photo editing and video editing at the same time.
Makes total sense. And less icons on the screen, the better.
Yes. No badge icons either.
We also talked about Chromebooks last week, and we were mentioning that Android apps were coming to the Chromebooks. And you actually purchased a Chromebook that is able to run the Android apps, and you have been running the Android apps. So tell us a little bit about how this experience is going for you.
Well, the Chromebook that I purchased was the Asus C302. It's an all-aluminum build Chromebook with a Core M3 processor in it, 4 gig of RAM. It has the Android app capability on the beta channel. In fact, right now we're doing a Hangout on this Chromebook, and I'm doing a recording with an Android app. The experience has actually been quite phenomenal, a lot better than I was expecting going into this. I was expecting some crazy stuttering or maybe a lot of force-closed apps, but I have yet to find a single one that hasn't worked properly. I don't know if that's to Asus's credit or Google's credit for getting all the tools down to the developers, but the experience has been rock solid. And it's just made me really reevaluate what I want to recommend to people for home use.
To me, the Chromebook, I guess for a personal device, has always seemed to me to be if everything that you have lives in the cloud. And I know that they've made some things different with Google and Chrome OS about being able to do some things offline and use the Chromebook offline. But have you found yourself like using the Android apps as if to make the Chromebook seem more like a traditional desktop or a laptop?
Honestly, there's only a couple Android apps that I do have on here right now. Of course, this audio recording app, because there's just not one available for Chrome OS. And then Microsoft RDP, because that RDP client is just phenomenal. But everything else, I'm using Chrome OS native apps, even to use a console cable into my switches. I'm using the Chrome OS apps. The only thing that's really irked me about what they've done with the recent update is, you know, they have the cross shell in there where you can do a Control-Alt-T or Control-Shift-T to open a terminal window inside of Chrome. Well, they removed the SSH command out of that, so that was kind of irritating to me. I don't know why they did it, but
that seems really strange considering Chrome OS is built on Linux and SSH like is how you manage Linux.
Yeah, it is. And they did some other things that are great to make up for, in my opinion. Like in the file browser now, you have an add new services option, which can browse services available for Chrome OS. And some of them are quite awesome. I mean, Secure Shell is one of those services where you can connect to SFTP shares, but they've also added in there a Samba service so you can connect to Windows shares and domain shares natively now. It's pretty neat.
Now all we need is a way to map home directories with a Google login.
This is true. But I guess they do that. It's called your drive.
What we actually need is the apps at the reverse. We need an app that a student logs in and maps their Google Drive as a map drive as opposed to their home directory.
Oh, dude, if anybody is listening that knows how to do that and doesn't want to charge $100 for it, please write that and open source it.
Yes, absolutely, because I know many school districts that would love that feature.
Yeah, but overall, I've been pleasantly surprised with the experience on this Chromebook. I mean, the Android apps run great. I've run a couple games on there just to see the GPU performance, and it's an Intel integrated GPU, so you know what you're dealing with there. But as far as Android, that's more GPU power than a lot of the phones have.
So what do the apps look like? Are they like upscaled Android apps from the tablet, or do they take the phone app and do something funky with it, or how does that actually look on the device?
Well, on this particular device, it doesn't have the resizable windows yet, so it's either a smaller window or a full screen window. It does default to the tablet view, but if the app doesn't have tablet view, the small window will be vertical like on a phone, and if you go full screen, what you do is you end up having the black pillars on the side.
I got you. So it's almost, in a way, it seems like it might be almost simulating the apps running.
Well, what I'm pretty convinced that they're doing is they're using the Arc Welder framework, which was the Android runtime components for Chrome from about a year and a half ago. And I think they're just trying to extend those capabilities in Arc Welder to have a better experience. Now, like on those pillared apps, if I did rotate the laptop sideways, the pillars went away.
Oh, that's just what you need to do, rotate the laptop.
Yeah, well, the screen does flip all the way around the back like a tablet, so it is a possibility.
Well, there we go. So it looks like the apps, Android apps on a Chromebooks are going to be a win for education once we can finally get them.
Yeah, it looks wonderful. In fact, in my my G Suite console, I have the Android apps enabled, and I have gone in there and improved quite a bit of them just to see what the experience would be for the end user. And, well, only those apps show up when you go to the Google Play Store. One of the things I do not like about what they're doing is those apps do approve, and they are in there, but they're all on one big page. There's no categories.
Yeah, maybe they'll fix that one day.
I imagine they will, because this is real early beta as far as the education side of G Suite.
Or at least give you the ability to make your own categories.
That would be what I'd want. And then there are some incompatibilities, like the Adobe Premiere app that is in the store, which, by the way, was not rumor. It is really in there.
Oh, there we go.
It's called Adobe Premiere Clip. It's a very reduced functionality, but it is Adobe Premiere. Well, that one does not work inside of the Chromebook version of Android. All the other apps from Adobe do, but just not that one.
I got you. It probably has a lot to do with like some more GPU horsepower and stuff like that.
I'm sure. Or they wrote a lot of stuff directly to the ARM processors as far as native, and they didn't write anything for x86 like this particular notebook is.
Oh, well, good. Well, we'll have to check in with you as we do this to see how the Android on Chrome OS is, how that experience, as they continue to add features and apps update to be able to work with it, see how things go. Because that would solve a lot of problems with using the Chromebooks in the schools to be able to have those apps, to be able to do that content creation and stuff that some people want to do.
Yeah, and just to be, so I have a real good perspective of it, I have shelved my normal laptop that I carry around to work on and using this exclusively.
More power to you.
Well, that's how you see what's really wrong, is by living in it and running into those problems.
That's true. I don't know if I'd be able to give up my MacBook to be able to do that. I'd carry the Chromebook around sometimes, like when I need to go do something real quick in a classroom, and I know I can do it in Chrome, and I won't need the Mac for whatever it is I need to go do. And it's kind of handy, even though the Chromebook weighs about as much as my Mac does. But
well, this is true, but you got to remember, what I was carrying around was the Dell Venue, and it was one of the first 2-in-1s from Dell, and I think it weighs about 32 pounds.
There you go. And the keyboard weighed about 25 of it.
Yeah, I think they had an 8-pound battery inside of it. That only worked about half the time. Actually, on that notebook, this is just something I got to get out there, Dell. Why in the world did you do this? If you have a dead battery dock, and you plug the tablet back into the battery dock, it sucks the battery down that's in the tablet to charge the keyboard. Don't do that.
It's kind of like the Nintendo Switch when it came out, because it's a USB-C device, I think, and so people were plugging it into their laptops thinking that they could try to charge the Switch with the laptop, and it was in fact charging the laptop with the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, that's hilarious when those kind of issues happen. I don't know how they miss those things, but wow. So my keyboard would be fully charged, but my tablet would be completely dead.
That's too funny. That's hilarious. But I guess if it's using the same battery, I guess it doesn't really matter which one it's using or which one it's charging.
And this is true. And it charged over a micro USB port at about half the speed of smell.
There you go. But since we're on the subject of Google and Chromebooks, let's talk a little bit about I.O. Did anything come out of I.O. that really stood out to you?
Well, them expanding Google Assistant is huge as far as I'm concerned. It seems like that is their go-to product moving forward. They're going to integrate all of their services and all of their new things into this AI product, which, well, it's quite cool. I mean, the fact that they're not locking down Google Assistant to one device now really opens the possibilities up to all the Android users.
It's like they're building Skynet.
No, they are building Skynet. Let's not mix words.
It's really interesting to see how each of these companies are taking their assistant technology. You have Amazon and Google with the Echo and Google Assistant and the Google Home product. It's like everything is based on like cloud processing and stuff. And then you have Apple that's taken the complete opposite effect, and it's everything is done locally on the device. It's like Siri will send your voice stuff up to Siri server to do like some speech to text recognition or whatever, but it can only knows about what's on the device that you're interacting with Siri. So if you say, Siri, show me pictures of whatever, it's only going to show you pictures from that device. It won't be able to pull from other devices that you may have attached to your iCloud account. It's only going to show you what's on the device.
It's a very different approach that Google's taking, because everything of theirs is processed up there in their data centers. In fact, so much that they've created new hardware just for that processing. I mean, they did release their TPUs, which I really don't know what the T stands for. I know it's a processing unit, but maybe it's Terminator processing unit, but
probably.
Anyway, it has 45 teraflops of processing power. That's like four 1080 Ti's. I mean, it's an incredible AI processing power. So they're doing all this up in the cloud. Apple's doing it all locally. I mean, it's very, well, it's obviously opposing viewpoints.
Apple states the reason why they do this is a security and privacy concern. Do you think people trust Google enough with their data to be able to use these services, but how do you feel about all that?
Well, I see both sides of the coin. I mean, Apple, with their very public iCloud hacks, has to be very, very cautious about how they present data up in the cloud now. Google hasn't really had that really bad PR event yet, so they can continue doing on things as normal. I'm sure Apple will end up pushing everything back up to the cloud, because these little chips that we have in these devices just don't have a lot of compute power. I mean, a 45 teraflops of power is ridiculous. And then the fact that you can scale them out to, I think he said 64 in each node, is insane.
I know I wish Apple would push some things back up to the cloud, because I know that my phone is doing face detection to try to find people in your photos album, and the iPad is doing face detection to try to find people in the photos album, and your Mac, and iPhoto was doing it before. It would kind of scan for faces in your pictures and kind of group pictures together of certain people and get you to put names on or whatever. I have to do that on all three devices. None of that data is syncing between the devices. None of that face detection data. And it's kind of a pain, because it's like, I want to see pictures of my kid on one device. I have to like set it all up and add the name to all the pictures and select all the ones that are him. And then I have to turn right back around and do it on the iPad and then on the Mac for a third time.
Oh my, you think they would share that information, because once either any of them process that information, that seems like it'd be a no-brainer to go ahead and sync that up.
Even their search ability, like where you could, they started adding in some of the search functions like Google Photos has, but none of that ever leaves the device. So like if you have pictures of horses and you do a search for horse, it's only going to give you results based on that device, on things that it scanned on that device, not all of your other devices, and learned from photos there.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I will give Apple credit where credit is due. That's some pretty powerful scaling that they've managed to put on all their devices. The fact that the MacBook, the iPad, and the lesser iPhones all can handle that code. I mean, that's impressive that they've managed to work it on that.
Well, it does it when it's plugged in and not really being in use. So, I mean,
oh, okay. I guess it can ramp up the processor usage then when it's got power tethered.
Yeah, I think those processes pretty much run overnight whenever you have your phone charging and you're not really using it. And I think the Mac is the same way. I think when it does its photo analysis based on, like, usage on the processor, and so, like, if it sees that nothing's really going on, nothing's happening, it'll start doing some photo analysis.
Well, that's pretty neat. Now, Google did say that all of their the same features, the facial recognition, the sharing and all that, is happening up in Google Photos, the web app, not any of the local apps. So they're going to be doing some of those same things that you've been doing within your iPhoto libraries now within Google Photos.
And, you know, Google, they make some great things. I mean, we saw that video or that picture where they took the fence when that kid playing baseball or whatever, they took the fence that was between the camera and the kid. They took the fence out, and that's just amazing. But I really don't know how I feel about them taking my data and anonymizing it, obviously. I mean, they're not going to give out my name and information, but then they sell it to advertisers. I mean, Google essentially is an advertisement company, and I just really don't know how I feel about all that, to be completely honest with you. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I kind of like Apple's... it's one of the reasons why I put up with a lot of Apple's faults when it comes to their cloud services and problems that you deal with and headaches, is because I know that Apple's not in it to make money. As far as we know, Apple is not selling my data to advertisers when Google is obviously doing it. And so I just don't know... I don't know how I feel about people making money off me. But I could just be crazy and thinking that, to be honest with you.
Well, that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, Apple makes their money on hardware. Google makes their money on your information. That's how it's always been.
I guess the good thing is, except for Chrome sync data, because apparently that was excluded from the education stipulation that they wouldn't use student and teacher data attached to Google Apps for Education, or really, I think, any Google Apps. I keep calling it Google Apps instead of G Suite. Any paid G Suite enterprise or education users, I don't think they use that data for advertising purposes, except for that one time when they found out that it was Chrome Sync that was actually doing it.
Yeah, that's one of the things they do say as far as the paying customers, is they will not present ads to them or take that information for advertising from within G Suite. Oh, one more thing I wanted to go ahead and talk on there. About that fence picture that we were seeing, a lot of that processing goes back to their AI that they're developing. They're claiming that the Google Assistant visual processing unit, I think they're calling it Lens, is more accurate at recognizing what a device or a thing is by the image than a human now. They're saying humans had like 86%, and then this was at 90% correct every time.
Yeah, I think that was getting kind of crazy good in a way, that AI is getting that smart. And then they also said that the voice recognition is getting pretty close to human capability of detection too.
Yeah, I think they were reporting only a 4.6 error rate in their voice detection without the learning capabilities turned on.
Well, Google has always had, I think, the best voice detection. And a lot of that has to do with they take our data and our voice captures and stuff like that, and they scan it with all their devices. And then they bought whatever it was that became Google Voice that did voice transcriptions for voicemails. And so they had that technology, and it probably just kind of grew from there.
Yeah, it was Grand Central. And they did say when they bought it, they were buying it for voice detection processing. And in fact, when it first moved over to Google Voice from Grand Central, I used to get emails that would ask, was this voicemail translated correctly and where was it wrong?
I get Apple started doing voicemail transcriptions in iOS 10, and they give me that option too. Is this voicemail good or not? And it's never good. So.
Well, honestly, I love that feature. It doesn't work real well with a Southeast Texas accent, but I love being able to read the voicemail instead of having to listen to it.
Well, the thing that I liked most about it was because if you were doing it on a phone and somebody left a message and they said their number and it transcribed the number right, you could just tap the number and call right then.
Now, I did have a few times, actually I still have it all the time because I still use Google Voice daily, where it'll have a call from number and then the number that the person read to me was not that same number that it would have transcribed even though it was supposed to be. So you had to be careful which one you touched to call back because you may be calling some random person that's asleep.
There you go.
And always, always, always dial the area code when you're using Google Voice, because it just pops out in a random spot in the country if you don't.
There you go. There's no telling who you're calling at that point.
That's why I have 95 cents in Google Voice credit instead of a dollar, because I forgot to dial the area code once.
I think mine was only, I think I only have the 10 cent credit that we got originally for whenever I signed up.
Well, I think they owe me more than that credit, because I actually paid the $20 to port my phone number up there.
There you go. I mean, you're all in with it.
They better be nice to me.
But yeah, it seemed Google I/O, at least day one, and that's all I've really been able to see was day one stuff. It was a lot to do with AI stuff. Now, there were some YouTube announcements and stuff like that, but I don't really think any of that kind of pertains to education. I don't really see about really getting any kind of benefit as far as any of those kind of announcements. A lot of that seemed like consumer stuff, and I really don't even know a lot of their AI stuff, if a lot of that can be brought over to the education market, but a lot of it was just really cool, and we wanted to talk about it for a little bit.
Yeah, and I see them marketing the untethered Daydream headset to education, just like they're doing, kind of like the 3D printer and the Makerspace stuff. I can see that being marketed to education as far as content creation.
Exactly. And maybe with the new Android Go that they came out with, maybe that would provide us some low-cost Android tablets for education.
Maybe. I bet Amazon's going to take Android Go, run with it on them low-cost Fire tablets anyway.
There you go. Those $50 Fire tablets. And they did announce new Fire tablets, I think, yesterday, too, or this morning. So,
how ironic.
It seems to be like a thing. Everybody just, once one starts, everything just sort of falls into place and everybody else starts doing it, too.
Well, I guess at least they're doing this at the end of the year so we can plan for our budgetary cycle starting in August.
It's like one thing that I really noticed was, at least on day one, Google mentioned nothing about accessibility features in Android or Google Home or Google Assistant or anything like that. Nothing about accessibility features. And then Apple drops these three YouTube interviews talking about accessibility. It's almost like, hey, you forgot about this. What about all this stuff? Here's what we're doing and why it's important. It's like these companies just can't let each other have their own day in the sunlight.
No, and I guarantee Google is going to rely on Assistant for just about all of their accessibility options in the near future. Now, I don't know what they're going to do for the mute, but Assistant's going to end up taking over the accessibility.
Well, with the mute, it's like they could just type it in and just have Google Assistant say it to whatever they need to do.
This is true. They did announce that you could type to all of the Google products now.
Oh, and you know, speaking of, there is a way that the new Google Assistant is going to help out in education. They showed off with Google Lens or whatever where you could take pictures of like signs at restaurants and do the translations for different things in menus, and they even showed this thing where they took a picture of a flower and to see what kind of flower it was. And so that could really come into education, especially like taking pictures of leaves to discover leaves, flowers, or insects, or any other things that you can use some augmented reality for.
Yeah, that'd be really cool in a biology class. Hey, let's walk outside and see all the different species plants that are around our building.
And maybe while you're dissecting the frog, you could take pictures of it, and Google can tell you what the parts are.
Hey, this is a kidney.
I hated that part of science class. I didn't like cutting things open.
And it just smelled bad, too.
Yeah, and we always did. And did you have to do the kitten?
Well, no, we didn't have kittens. We had cats.
Oh, we just did a frog. That's the most I had to do was a frog.
Yeah, we had the frog in, I think it was 7th grade, and then we had the cat when we were a freshman in high school. And then there was a pig. Somebody had to do a pig, I didn't have that one.
We had to do a pig, too. But, you know, maybe that's where this VR and AR stuff can come into. Maybe they could do one animal and then do a VR movie or whatever, and then so everybody just kind of watches that and interacts with that for the dissection instead of actually having to do the real thing.
Now, how are we going to traumatize our kids if we do that?
Oh, that's true. But I guess that's kind of Google I/O and how it kind of affects education. It doesn't really affect us too much, but I mean, the Google Assistant and the VR stuff will be kind of beneficial for us. I'll have to check out what happened on day two today as we record and see if anything new came out of there, to see if there's anything we could talk about next week as far as follow up on or continuation on Google I/O. But some other news, you're a processor nut, so and AMD came out with some new stuff, so I'll just let you have at it with some new AMD processors.
First off, you have to hand it to the AMD marketing department here lately. They have some awesome imagery. They have some awesome names coming out. I mean, the three announcements that they had this past week, of course, they announced some of the Vega, their new high-end GPU details, but they also released a processor called Threadripper, and then another data center processor called Epic. I mean, that's like awesome naming. That's like some teenage boy is running their department to name things, and I absolutely love it. I mean, Threadripper is going to be a scaled-up version of the Ryzen CPUs that they have now using the Naples socket, so they can have up to 16 cores and 32 threads on a desktop processor. That's impressive already.
That's a lot of processing power.
Oh, and it gets even better. It gets epic. They release their new server chip designs, which have 32 physical cores and 64 threads. I mean, can you imagine trying to license Windows Data Center for this thing?
It's going to cost a fortune.
Oh, and you can put two of them on the same motherboard.
Oh, geez, that is going to be some... That's 128 cores, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, unless you disable simultaneous multi-threading, you're going to have to pay for 128 data center license for this CPU. It's insanity. But what's so cool about it is not only do you have all these cores to deal with, they have up to 128 PCIe Gen 3 lanes, and it can access up to 4 terabytes of memory locally in 8 channels. It's insanity.
So what do we use this hardware for in server environments? Obviously it's going to make some killer environments, but with everything moving to the cloud, do you see this basically runs the cloud, in my opinion?
That, and I think we all need to run Minecraft on it.
There you go.
I mean, that is an effective use of resources, Minecraft.
Minecraft.
But no, what AMD is doing is they're touting these things as far as for artificial intelligence. That's also what this first Vega GPU has come out with. It's called the Frontier Edition, which I guess was just their ploy on NVIDIA's Founders Edition. They needed the same letters to line up, so they have Frontier. But they're touting the GPU for artificial intelligence and machine learning. Now, the Vega GPU, they're part of the high bandwidth memory bandwagon. They're one of the creators of this memory, which if you keep up with different memory formats as far as GPUs, there's been GDDR5 for a really long time, and then 2 years ago, NVIDIA and the GDDR consortium released GDDR5X memory, which gave it like 11 gigabits of throughput. HBM2 has 480 gigabits of throughput per second.
That can run some serious VDI.
Dude, it's incredible. And the first chip that they're releasing on this, it has it has 8 gigabytes of HBM2 memory with that 480 gigabits per second of throughput. But they have a technology that AMD's created called high bandwidth cache, which different vendors can create different memory layouts so they can actually address up to 4 terabytes of video memory. So a vendor could actually create a PCI card that just has traditional DDR4 memory in it, and that GPU could actually access that memory directly without going over the PCI bus.
That's going to be some screaming fast technology.
It's a real interesting time as far as this hardware is concerned, because for the past, well, let's be honest, it's been 10 years since AMD's done anything that's been worthwhile, and Intel has really stagnated in the past 5. They haven't had to do any innovation.
I haven't used anything AMD as far as processor-wise since my Windows XP days with my Athlon XP processor.
And to be quite frank, that, until Ryzen came out, was the last good thing AMD released. Now, I am a little partial. I love AMD. I always have. But I haven't had an Athlon since that XP. And now, I do have a Ryzen processor, a Ryzen build at home. I run a Ryzen 1700 overclocked to 3.9 gigahertz. And the thing's a beast. It's awesome. So I can't wait to play with some of these new Vega GPUs. And if I can just let me touch one of these new Naples CPUs with a 32 cores, that would just make my day.
And see, and that's the thing, you and I both, we're sort of real big data center guys. We still run the virtualization environments on site. We do a lot of things in the cloud, but there's still a lot of things that we do locally. And you don't really hear a lot of data center news coming out. And so it's really good that AMD is actually pushing the market forward and giving Intel Xeon some competition.
Oh yeah, they're actually beating, with these new Naples CPUs, they're beating the IPC of the current Xeons, which are about 2 generations back on Intel's architecture. So their instructions per clock are higher than Intel, their power consumption's lower than Intel, and their price is lower. So, but yet AMD stock's down 25%. Now, while I can't give financial advice, people, they're down 25% and they have better products all the way around. Go buy some stock.
It's almost like there should be a company that builds computers that seems to be slow in updating things, and a lot of that blame has to be put on Intel. It's almost like that would be like a partnership made in heaven, you know?
It seems like that would really align well, especially in Q2 when they release the mobile chips.
And considering that it has been a 2, 3, 4 years since they've actually came out with a real good professional grade machine for people that do video marketing or video creation, audio editing, development. It's almost like there should be a company that needs a processor like this and needs some hardware like that and some GPUs.
Are you saying that we need to put one of these epic CPUs in a trash can?
Maybe so. Maybe not necessarily a trash can, but maybe something a little bit more modular this time. I think it might could work. If only there was a company out there that needed this kind of stuff.
You know, and how awesome would it be to have a GPU that wasn't an Intel integrated in your MacBook, Matt? Wouldn't you love to have a real GPU like an AMD Radeon?
Yes, that would be great. That way, we don't have to worry about apps building in the ability to switch between a discrete GPU and an integrated GPU.
Come on, fruit company. Listen to us.
There you go. But for our last bit of news this week, we want to talk about the ransomware that went out. Ransomware seems to always be a problem. And it's actually going to lead into our topic, which we're going to kind of postpone for next week, because we want to spend a little bit more time on talking about security and for your school districts and stuff like that, and talk about the things that we do to try to protect ourselves, and not just about, hey, we run this antivirus, we run this firewall, but just kind of talk about, hey, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. But having this WannaCrypt and this WannaCry, or whatever variation it was, hit the news was like, we definitely need to talk about this. And so that's what we're going to do today. I do want to mention that in our area, we have had some experience with the ransomware and the crypto locker, as I think is what it was called before when it was hit here. We had a school district that you and I both know, and they had a bout with it. And luckily, they had some offsite backups that didn't back up the encrypted stuff, so they were able to restore their data without paying a ransom. But why do you think that this type of malware attack is becoming so prominent?
Well, I think it's so prominent because it doesn't have to have escalated user privileges. So anything that the current user has access to read and write to, it can affect. And it's very, very effective. I mean, there is no way without the encryption key, you're going to decrypt these files because they're using hardened real-world encryption.
I mean, and encryption's a great thing. Don't get me wrong. I am all for encryption, except when somebody else is encrypting your stuff.
I mean, this is true. I mean, you have to look to the fact that the FBI is even recommending paying the ransom to get your data back.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember we went to a meeting and they were talking about that some people have had luck paying the ransom, and then some people, they pay the ransom and they don't get anything back.
Yeah, I think this particular incident, there wasn't anyone that got the information back from paying. And I think that's a bad move on this virus creator's. A bad move on him because, well, in the end, this may sound crazy, but he's selling a product. If he doesn't deliver on his promise, why would anyone actually pay him again? So if someone paid and didn't get their information back, why, let's say, Jimmy over here, he got infected, why would he pay the ransom to the guy if he's not guaranteed to get his data back?
Exactly. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't pay anyway.
Oh, I wouldn't either. But if he's expecting people to pay, he better give it back when they do.
Yeah.
Otherwise, his money-making scheme's over.
So how did this infection or this attack happen? What was, like, how did it get in?
Well, I honestly believe, and I think Microsoft talked about it, there was some of the, let's say, Vault 7 leaks that have been used and kind of coming out about, you know, those pocketed NSA loopholes and whatnot in Microsoft security. That information went public not too long ago.
Yeah, I remember all that.
So unpatched systems were affected. And of course, Windows XP systems are always going to be affected now.
Yeah, because especially considered Microsoft killed all support for them.
Yeah, so unless you had a really up-to-date antivirus that knew exactly the patterns to look for, there wasn't a whole lot you could do about this. Now, a lot of the antivirus companies claim that they stopped it, but well, you know how that is. Can you really trust the person selling their product to tell the truth about their product?
Exactly. I heard about this from the hospitals over in the UK getting hit with it. And from what I understand, they actually continued to pay Microsoft a lot of money to be able to continue to patch Windows XP for them because they had to use it. Now, we can get into a big discussion and a big back and forth debate with a lot of people over, is it a good idea to pay for that to keep using an outdated operating system? But we know from an education standpoint that a lot of time, you really have no choice but to continue to run the outdated OS or not patch certain things or have to run certain older versions of certain things, especially like Java or Flash, because we have to use software that has not been updated to be able to use newer technology or newer applications or newer versions of stuff that have been patched. And so we have to use these older versions of software to be able to accomplish certain tasks. And so somebody put out an article, I think it was The Verge, that says, is Microsoft to blame for this large ransomware attack? Is it Microsoft's fault because they didn't continue to patch XP for this? And I don't know if I would agree to that. I mean, they can be faulted a little bit because, I mean, if they know about the patch, go ahead and push it out. What's the big deal? But also, why not put some blame on these software vendors for this software that we have to use that requires us not to be able to update?
I agree completely. You got to stop and think about this. When did Windows XP come out? It came out 16 years ago. When was the last time you saw any company support a product for 16 years? I mean, are you going to go buy a car and them give you a bumper-to-bumper for 16 years?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not, and they'd be foolish to offer something like this. I mean, there has been a lot of changes in everything since 2001. And I don't think Microsoft could have pushed a patch down to Windows XP to prevent this. Perhaps they could, because they don't know the state of that machine and what all other patches have. What's on the machine? What's it going to break by pushing this one piece of new code down to a 16-year-old operating system? Now, in all transparency, I have a single XP machine in our district. I hate that I have this machine. But the Cummins software that we use for our bus maintenance requires it.
See, there's always something that's requiring it. And I told the person that told me about this, and so we were talking about it, I told him, I was like, believe it or not, and I gave him the reasons why a lot of people still run XP. It's because of these older softwares that they have to run. I said, believe it or not, there's still a lot of ATM machines out there in the world that are running Windows XP.
Well, fortunately for those ATM machines, they're running the embedded version of XP, which actually still has current security updates at least till the end of 2018.
Well, there you go, but it's still a 16-year-old operating system.
Oh, yeah. It's time to let it go. I mean, and at this point, if you have a machine that you have to run XP on, you need to make sure it's isolated in your environment, and if it has to get out to the internet, it needs to be on its own way out to the internet where it can't communicate with anything back into your network.
But yes, it's time that I don't really know who we can point the blame to, but definitely isolate those machines in your environment if you're forced to run older versions of OS. I know the experience at the school district that we know about that it happened to, it actually got in through an open RDP port that they had open in the firewall. And so it's not just these security patches that Microsoft has, it's also really anything. And so you always have to make sure that you have things like that closed that you don't need open. And so isolate those XP machines as best you can, but also make sure that like nothing can get in that's not supposed to get in. There's no open ports that they're common remote access ports open.
Especially with those services like a remote desktop protocol, it's not just a protocol for viewing the screen. It has a clipboard, it can push printers across, it can move files across, it can do all sorts of things. It's encapsulating that entire workstation service over this one port and protocol. It's dangerous to have public. If you need to get to a machine internally, publicly, use a VPN or use some sort of proxying client. There's an open source one called Guacamole, which works real well, to where it's encapsulated in an HTTPS session so those protocols aren't exposed.
Exactly. And we're going to talk more about that next week whenever we talk about some things that we do personally to help protect our networks. I'm assuming you had all the Microsoft patches pushed out as best you could to keep this from happening, because I know I did.
Well, let's just say they're in WSUS. Whether or not it's pushed down to every machine, I haven't looked at the report. I think I'm sitting somewhere around 99.5.
It's the machine is as secure as the person that's clicking reboot later. Postpone later. Postpone
and I don't know
for
if
4 hours.
And I'm the world's worst about it. My desktop finally just didn't give me the option to reboot later the other day because I had hit remind me in 8 hours about 12 times.
There you go. I know I had to go work on a Surface Book the other day because the mouse and keyboard, the external mouse and keyboard connected to the dock kind of quit working. And the problem ended up being was because it needed an update from finishing the creator's update on it. And I love how Windows 10, it even tells you, it's like, hey, we'll try to reboot your laptop between this hours of da-da-da or whatever, but you can reboot now for a better experience.
You know, we should heed those warnings because they probably know what they're talking about.
Exactly. And so all that problem could have been fixed with a simple reboot. And so reboot those computers when they tell you that they need to be rebooted. Do it on your way to lunch or whatever. Just click reboot, and by the time you get back, it'll probably be done, hopefully.
This is true. Now, and that's especially important when we get into what we're going to be talking about next week, because if it's a kernel level update, it needs to reboot to patch that really bad vulnerability.
I've had Office updates that needed a reboot.
Oh, good Lord, Office.
I mean, I am of the mindset that if you get any kind of update, just reboot, because things will be better if you just reboot. Services will restart and use the correct files, and everything will just run better. But we can talk about that more next week. We're going to finish up this week since we're coming up on our time. We're going to talk more next week about the security and the things that we can do and just kind of give some recommendations, or at least what's been working for us to try to keep how we've kept our staff and students protected from these kind of attacks. So if you have any questions or feedback or anything you want us to discuss next week when we talk about security, you can reach out to us on Twitter. Chris can be found at @Feeks. I am @TwistOfMatt. Or you can contact the show account at Educating Tech. Also, send us an email at educatingtech@gmail.com. Yes, we're using Google, so anything you send to us will be scanned and used for advertising purposes. For more episodes, you can visit educatingtech.net, and you can also find links to subscribe in your favorite podcast app, or at least my favorite podcast apps, and you can have it download onto your phone or whatever you listen to podcasts on automatically. And so we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
Thanks, Matt.